Greetings to all members and friends of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club. This is VK3OTN.
And I am Ian, VK3JS.
And I am Bruce, VK3UV. And together we present our broadcast bulletin of news and information for October 2020. We thank our volunteer operators who relay this broadcast on a number of frequencies and modes, which can all be found on our website, www.raotc.org.au. This month we have our normal club news and several interesting articles, and ending up with this month's joke. COVID-19. By the time this bulletin goes to air, all members would have received the September edition of our magazine, OTN. However, there may be some postal delays due to the COVID restrictions. At the time of recording this bulletin, we here in Melbourne are still in stage 4 lockdown of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. However, I am pleased to advise that the pandemic has eased somewhat and restrictions on our movements are about to be reviewed. RAOTC Management Committee. The RAOTC committee has learned through experience that committee meetings conducted by video conferencing are quite practical and has decided that future committee meetings post the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions will most likely be conducted wholly by video conferencing or a combination of video conferencing and face-to-face. On Thursday, the 22nd of August, the first Zoom meeting of the Management Committee was conducted, and it was a great success. In fact, the meeting only went for just on 1 hour, and was at least 50% shorter than our normal face-to-face meetings. The normal reports were presented, our finances are in good shape, and membership levels are constant at around 480. The broadcast report came in for some interesting discussions, with particular mention being made of the poor HF conditions which affect the broadcast. 20 metres is still very patchy. As this news and information broadcast was prepared prior to the online Zoom annual general meeting, which was expected to be held on Thursday the 22nd of September, it was resolved that the number of full members that are required to make up a quorum was 33. Also, if a secret ballot is required for the election of the committee in accordance with the RAOTC constitution, some in-depth discussion as to how that could be arranged was held. A full report of the AGM and advice of the members making up the committee will be presented in our November broadcast. New members. We now have advice of 4 new members, and we welcome the following. Andrew Clinkerberry, VK3 HFA, became new associate RAOTC member number 1792 on the 4th of September 2020. Alan Hall, VK3 AJH, previous calls VK5 NAH, VK5 KNN, and VK3KEY, and he became new full RAOTC member number 1793 on the 9th of September 2020. And also on the same date, we have Marty O'Reeve, VK3AKG, previous call sign VK3XMO, and he became a new full member number 1794. And we have Rob Young, VK4QZ, previous call sign H44QX, and he became a new associate RAOTC member number 1795 on the 14th of September 2020. Now, unfortunately, we have advice of a silent key. We have been belatedly advised that Tom Ivins, VK4ABA, RAOTC member number 1382, became a silent key in June of this year. So we now pause for a few moments in memory of our departed colleague. Thank you. This is VK3OTN, a station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia.
Here's an article from OTN Journal No. 1 of March 1985, page 11. It's a story that I imagine would resonate with many of the senior old-timers today, perhaps even some of the younger ones as well. But there we are, things don't change all that much. So the article is entitled Two Sparks. It was October 1951. The taxi dropped me at the entrance to Victoria Dock, Melbourne. I paid the driver, recovered my case and bag from the back seat, and he said, "If you don't know where your ship is, mate, the blokes in there will tell you," pointing to the staff in the glass entrance cage. The officer said, "The old Mulcra, eh? Same as usual, 6 North Wharf, right around, just joining?" I said yes, and I was marched off to find this wonderful vessel. Walking along, I thought, how did all this start? When I was much younger, during World War II, it was the crystal set, of course. Scrounging a tuning condenser and cat's whisker detector, winding a coil on a cardboard tube, and then buying a set of old headphones for 2 shillings and 6p. We were living at Ararat, which was a long way from any broadcast station, so a large aerial was erected, connected up, and the miracle happened. It worked, so I was hooked on this wireless business. I had read about spark transmitters and thought that my buzzer, as the contacts produced a fine spark, might also be a transmitter. With a small aerial connected, it sounded great on the crystal set, but my parents and the neighbours were not impressed, missing their radio programmes. The experiment was very quickly aborted. I soon found the only amateur in town, George Turner, VK3GN, and he invited me around to his shack. There was no transmitting gear, but there was an old shortwave receiver and a stack of amateur radio books. The fascination of hearing signals from around the globe was immense. From then on, George was my mentor, and we started with Ohm's Law from the 1938 edition of the ARRL handbook, with all the theory that followed. I started to find out what it was all about. The next thing was the Morse code. When the war ended and the examination for the amateur radio operator's certificate of proficiency were being held again, I decided to sit. The examination was held in the local post office and I was the only applicant. Struggling through the papers, I decided they were not too bad, but what of the Morse test? How could a professional 30 words a minute telegraphist be able to keep down to the speed required of amateur operators? I need not have worried. The CW was immaculate. Some weeks later, the letter arrived advising that I had passed and could apply for a call sign. The transmitter, crystal controlled on 80 and 40 metres, and the TRF receiver were ready to go when the call, VK3IQ, was allocated, and I heard my first QSO with VK3GN across town. George was the projectionist at the local Midlands Theatre, and sometimes later I joined him as an assistant. He had a Type 3 Mark II transmitter up in the projection box, and we would take it in turn to work the W's or whatever with an aerial up to the flagpole on the building. Happy days. Later on, I passed the broadcast operator's certificate of proficiency and was employed in country radio as a technician, breakfast announcer, record librarian, and anything else that was going with a staff of 8. Great fun. And then the commercial operator's certificate of proficiency. But stop reminiscing. There's your ship. The Mulcra was not exactly a cruise ship, being old and rather rusty. And as I found out later, it had a registered tonnage of 550 tons, and with me, a brand new uniform. I located the radio office when the retiring Sparks was waiting for me. I was explained that I was a first-time operator and was shown around the power board and the receiver. This unit also contained an emergency crystal set receiver. Then we came to the transmitter. The former radio officer said, "I suppose you know it's Spark." I said, "The emergency rig, you mean?" "No, this is the only transmitter." "You're kidding," I replied. "They've been banned under the Geneva Convention since..." Dead silence and a grin from the retiring Sparks. My mind went back to my early crystal and buzzer transmitter all those years ago. So the wheel had turned full circle. "Well, you had better show me how it works." The tuning was very simple. I believed these rigs were used as emergency transmitters for the merchant service during the war, and this one had a large wheel in the centre of the rack. I was told not to touch this because in the second position it would send out an automatic SOS signal. So if the ship had to be abandoned, the spark rig would keep sending until the batteries failed or the ship sank. I bade farewell to my peer and settled into the cabin, which was to be mine for some time. When the ship sailed, the aerial was hoisted and we passed through the rip into Bass Strait. It was now time to send the TR signal. This informed Melbourne Radio that we were at sea, we were on listening watch, our destination and our estimated time of arrival. The signal was sent and VIM replied with TR, R, TKS, CUL, AR. So the beast did work. I soon came to like this old outfit. The spark gap consisted of a stack of circular discs with cooling fins on the outside with mica rings separating them, the whole lot being in series. They were held in a large clamp, and the more power one wanted, the more discs one put in. About once a week, the clamp would be unscrewed and the whole assembly cleaned and polished. As far as I know, there were only three of these transmitters being used in Australian waters at this time, all in small ships on the Victoria Bass Strait South Australia run. They were all perfectly readable, particularly at night in these areas and doubtless farther afield than this. They were fine, primitive, honest and reliable devices. But when someone asks me what my first marine transmitter was, and I reply, "Spark," I'm not sure they believe me. My old friend George, VK3GN, is still in Ararat and is a long-time member of the RAOTC. When I relinquished my 3IQ call after some years away from Victoria, I found to my amazement when I returned to Melbourne, an old friend and workmate, John Smith, was holding that call. John is also a member of RAOTC, and I took the call VK3CV in 1961. And that article was written by Kevin Duff, VK3CV, in 1985.
This is VK3OTN. The uncertain future of ham radio. Software-defined radio and cheap hardware are shaking up a hobby long associated with engineering. This article appeared in the IEEE Spectrum of 10th of July 2020 and is written by Julianne Peppertone, who is a freelance technology, science and business journalist and a frequent contributor to IEEE Spectrum. Although it is American-based, the messages here are very pertinent to Australia. It is a lengthy article, so it is being split into two sections. This is part one, and part two will be broadcast next month. Will the amateur airwaves fall silent? Since the dawn of radio, amateur operators, hams, have transmitted on tenaciously guarded slices of spectrum. Electronic engineering has benefited tremendously from their activity, from the level of the individual engineer to the entire field. But the rise of the internet in the 1990s with its ability to easily connect billions of people, captured the attention of many potential hams. Now, with time taking its toll on the ranks of operators, new technologies offer opportunities to revitalise amateur radio, even if in a form that previous generations might not recognise. The number of US amateur licences has held at an anemic 1% annual growth for the past few years, with about 7,000 new licensees added every year, for a total of 755,430 in 2018. The US Federal Communications Commission doesn't track demographic data of operators, but, anecdotally, men in their 60s and 70s make up much of the population. As these baby boomers age out, the fear is that there are too few young people to sustain the hobby. It's the $60,000 question. How do we get the kids involved? Says Howard Michael, former CEO of the ARRL. The question of how to attract younger operators also reveals deep divides in the ham community about the future of amateur radio. Like any large population, ham enthusiasts are no monolith. Their opinions and outlooks on the decades to come vary widely, and emerging digital technologies are exacerbating these divides. Some hams see them as the future of amateur radio, while others grouse that they are eviscerating some of the best things about it. No matter where they land on these battle lines, however, everyone understands one fact. The world is changing. The amount of spectrum is not, and it will be hard to argue that spectrum reserved for amateur use and experimentation should not be sold off to commercial users if hardly any amateurs are taking advantage of it. Before we look to the future, let's examine the current state of play. In the United States, the ARRL is at the forefront, and with more than 160,000 members, it is the largest group of amateur radio operators in the world. Michael led the ARRL between October 2018 and January 2020, and he fits easily into the profile of the average American ham. The 66-year-old from Dartmouth, Massachusetts, credits his career in electrical and computer engineering to an early interest in amateur radio. He received his call sign WB2ITX 50 years ago and has loved the hobby ever since. When our president goes around and speaks to groups, he'll ask, "How many people here are under 20 years of age?" In a group of 100 people, he might get one raising their hand. The ARRL does sponsor some child-centric activities. But Michael readily admits, "We don't have the resources to go out to middle schools, which are the key for piquing children's interests." Sustained interest is essential because potential hams must clear a particular barrier before they can take to the airwaves, a licensing exam. But every country requires operators to demonstrate some technical knowledge and an understanding of the relevant regulations before they can get a registered call sign and begin transmitting. For those younger people who are drawn to ham radio, up to those in their 30s and 40s, the primary motivating factor is different from that of their predecessors. With the internet and social media services like WhatsApp and Facebook, they don't need a transceiver to talk with someone halfway around the world. Indeed, many are interested in the capacity for public service, such as providing communications in the wake of a disaster, or event communications for activities like city marathons. There's something about this post-9/11 group, having grown up with technology and having seen the impact of climate change, Michelle says. They see how fragile cell phone infrastructure can be. What we need to do is convince them that more than getting licensed and putting a radio in your drawer and waiting for the end of the world. New frontiers. The future lies in operators like Drew Reber, KC9ZJX, who won Amateur Radio Newsline's 2019 Young Ham of the Year Award. He's the 15-year-old son of immigrants from India, where he also runs Varsity Cross Country and is active in the Future Business Leaders of America and robotics clubs. And he's most interested in using amateur radio bands to communicate with astronauts in space. Reber earned his technician class license when he was 9, and after having visited the annual Dayton Hamvention with his father, my dad have kind of just brought me along, but then I saw all the booths and stalls in the Morse code, and I thought it was really cool, Reber says. It was something my friends weren't doing. He joined the Central Illinois Radio Club in Broomington, experimented with making radio contacts, participated in the ARRL's annual field days, and volunteered at the communications booths at local races. But then Reber found a way to combine ham radio with his passion for space. He learned about the amateur radio on the International Space Station, ARRIS, managed by an international consortium of amateur radio organisations, which allows students to speak directly to crew members aboard the ISS. There is even an automated digital transponder on the ISS that allows hams to ping the station as it orbits. Reber rallied his principal, science teacher and classmates at Chittix Junior High, and on 23rd of October 2017, they made contact with astronaut Joe Acaba, KE5DAR. For Reber, who served as the lead control operator, it was a crystallising moment. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia. The younger generation would be more interested in emergency communications and the space aspect, I think. We want to be making an impact, Reber says. The hobby aspect is great, but a lot of my friends would argue it was quite easy to talk with people overseas, with texting and everything, so it's kind of lost its magic. That statement might break the hearts of some of the more experienced hams, recalling their tinkering time in their childhood basements. But some older operators welcome the change. There are other hams who think that the amateur radio community needs to be much more actively courting change if it is to survive. Sterling Mann, N0SSC, himself a millennial at age 27, wrote on his blog that millennials are killing ham radio. It's a clickbait title, Mann admits. His blog post focuses on the challenges of balancing support for the dominant, greying ham population while pulling in younger people too. The target demographic at every single amateur radio show, podcast, club, media outlet, society, magazine, live stream or otherwise, is not young people, he wrote. To capture the interest of young people, he urges that ham radio give up its century-long focus on person-to-person contacts in favour of activities where human-to-machine or machine-to-machine communication is the focus. These differing interests are manifesting in something of an analog-to-digital technical divide. As Spectrum reported in July 2019, one of the key debates in ham radio is its main function of the future. Is it a social hobby? A utility to deliver data traffic? And who gets to decide? These questions have no definitive or immediate answers, but they cut to the core of the future of ham radio. Loring Cutchins, president of the Amateur Radio Safety Foundation, which funds and guides the global radio email system, Winlink, says the divide between hobbyists and utilitarians seems to come down to age. Younger people who have come along tend to see amateur radio as a service, as it's defined by the FCC rules, which outline the purpose of amateur radio, especially as it relates to emergency operations. Cutchins, 68, expanded on the theme in a recent interview. The people of my era will be gone. The people who got into it when it was magic to tune into Radio Moscow. But Grandpa's ham radio set isn't that big a deal compared to today's technology. That doesn't have to be sad. That's normal. This is the end of part one. Next month we will present part two, with some interesting comments from Martin F. Dewey, K5FLU, the founder of radio accessories maker MFJ Enterprises. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. This now concludes our bulletin for this month, and as per usual practice, here is this month's joke. When Mozart passed away, he was buried in a churchyard. A couple of days later, the town drunk was walking through the cemetery and heard some strange noise coming from the area where Mozart was buried. Terrified, the drunk ran and got the priest to come and listen to it. The priest bent close to the grave and heard some faint, unrecognizable music coming from the grave. The priest rang and got the town magistrate. When the magistrate arrived, he bent his ear to the grave, listened for a moment and said, "Ah, yes, that's Mozart's Ninth Symphony being played backwards." He listened a while longer and said, "There's the Eighth Symphony and it's backwards too. Most puzzling." So the magistrate kept listening. "There's the Seventh, the Sixth, the Fifth." Suddenly, the realization of what was happening dawned on the magistrate. He stood up and announced to the crowd that had gathered in the cemetery, "My fellow citizens, there's nothing to worry about. It's just Mozart decomposing." Ian and I hope that you have received something beneficial from this month's broadcast, and we will be back with you on Monday, the 2nd of November, 2020. Until then, and finally, to all club members, your families and friends, and all listeners, we hope that you will all stay safe and well in these troubled and unprecedented times. We now conduct a callback of stations who would like to comment on today's broadcast for those relay stations that do have an operator available. Thank you.